afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Wednesday afternoon, the 1st of April. It's April Fool's Day, all right. I got so much to cover. Oh, my God. Okay, yeah, this is ridiculous. I have so much to cover, folks. Obviously, just massive developments with the war in Iran. We'll get to all of those. And I mean massive. I mean, like, world-shaking, world-changing type of activity going on here. Donald Trump is apparently going to give a nationwide address prime time tonight. I don't know if that, I assume that'll happen after our show's over, but we'll keep an eye on it. And if he goes live while we're on air, then we'll go to that. Big addresses really across the world. You've got the PM of the UK, Keir Starmer, giving a big address. Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia, likewise gave an address having to do with the fuel lockdown that we told you to come, told you was coming. It is absolutely here now and going to get worse before it gets better. We also have the continuing fallout of Jaden Ivey being removed from the Bulls for not being sufficiently subservient to the LGBTQ community. We're going to be joined by Royce White in the next hour. He's going to talk to us about that. Tiffany Cianci has some inside information, some exclusive secret as of now information that she'll be bringing to us about pesticides and laws being written about pesticides right now. Just a very big show. And we'll be spending a lot of the first hour on the Supreme Court decision about birthright citizenship. And it's a doozy, folks. So just so much to get into. Stay with us. Let's begin today, as we do every day, with our Daily Dispatch. All right, here it is, folks, your Daily Dispatch for Wednesday, the 1st of April, 2026. Trump attends Supreme Court oral arguments in a presidential first. This is just how important this decision is, and it really could determine the fate of our republic from here on out. He spent about an hour listening to the government make its case against birthright citizenship at the Supreme Court on Wednesday, making him the first sitting president to attend oral arguments at the high court. His presence would put him face to face with justices whom he has tried to bully and intimidate, only raises the stakes of an already closely watched case about what it means to be an American, an issue that was key to his political rise. Of course, I really actually don't know what they're talking about when they say that he's been bullying the Supreme Court. I honestly can't think of an instance of that. I can think about Chuck Schumer telling the Supreme Court that they'll sow the wind and reap the whirlwind, but that wasn't Trump. However, we will get into clips from that. The audio that's come out is truly remarkable. And folks, it ain't looking good. You got Justice Roberts being a complete moron, and basically the entire thing hinges on Amy Coney Barrett. She's sort of the wild card, could go either direction. And that doesn't bode well for the future of our country. So our fate hinges on whether a middle-aged white Catholic woman with a rainbow coalition of children can stand to be just a little bit harsh with immigrants. People say mean. It's not mean to not give somebody something that isn't theirs. So it's not actually being mean to immigrants, but she does have to, you know, moderately not give them everything they want. And the fate of America hinges on that. We'll get back to it. Meanwhile, Iran denies Trump's claim that it requested a ceasefire, calling it false and baseless. The Iranian president has just released an open letter to the people of the world. I'll read that as well today. Trump to give primetime address on Iran war as questions swirl over his next move, considering the fact that there's no guiding principle here. In other words, they keep changing what they're saying about the war every couple of hours, sometimes every like within a minute or two. While at the same time, you can't actually say, well, they're saying all this stuff, but let's look tactically at the field and see what they can and can't do, because we're acting like complete idiots whose actions are not guided by any form of logic or common sense or victory conditions. Meanwhile, top Brussels official urges Europeans to work from home and drive less. We'll talk about the fuel lockdown that is here and only going to get worse. Finally, something dark is going on. 9 top-level scientists die or go missing in the past year, mostly from America. I'm sure it's enough. I'm sure it's fine. Go back to sleep. I'll be right back.
I've been an oil spill for as long as I've been an info warrior, 18 years. and Texan, born and raised, so I know like knives like you do. And I finally broke down and ordered one. I got the neon orange, and I'm blown away. I've had Benchmark knives that are easily $400. Had them for a year, lost them. This thing has the same feel, same quality, same, I mean, everything about it. I haven't had a knife stay this sharp in a long time, and I'm, like, horrible with equipment. I'm, like, very abusive with knives at work every day. I'm extremely impressed. I'm very impressed. So anybody out there listening, who knows if a knife comes back in stock, get one. You know, any of them. I want to get the Ring knife when it comes back out. Other than that, I'll join all the supplements and,
Yeah, particularly the pocket knives, the folding knives, the flip knives are super high quality at incredibly low prices. I mean, these same knives sell in stores all day for like $80, we're selling for like $40. We'll be right back.
You're watching The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'll tell you, I don't know if this interests you, but my day, basically, I you know, whenever I get in, usually I start, I'm never not working, right? I'm never not checking the news and compiling things and putting things in folders. But I will sit there from like noon until the show begins, and I'm just the whole time, I'm just copying links, downloading videos just the whole time, 3 hours straight. And everything's off. Like, I've already bookmarked everything over the last 24 hours, and it's just a matter of going through, putting it in the document so the crew can print it, all that stuff. But it's like, if we had, you know, 12 hours to go through all of this, maybe we could make a dent. But I've got a lot to cover today, so I'm going to try to get through Iran and the Supreme Court in this first hour. Second hour, we'll get into a lot of stuff with Royce White, but particular the, not just the firing, the releasing of Jaden Ivey from the Bulls because of his very moderate and reasonable stance about being forced to participate in LGBTQ Pride Month, but also that that's just in line with everything else that we see going on with people being punished for their just very baseline Christian beliefs. People like Karine Prejean Buller, who was kicked off of the Religious Tolerance Committee in for the White House. So we'll get into all that stuff. Then the third hour, I will be joined by Tiffany Cianci. She has some inside information. We have an exclusive some, as of right now, secret information about some upcoming pesticide bills in D.C. So stay tuned for that. We'll get into that in the third hour. But I could spend 12 hours just on, well, it's almost like we have to cover the updates of Iran in real time because things are changing so much, so rapidly, and with so little warning or seeming through line that combines it all. I literally have 40 videos of this. Just having to do just with the Middle East and Iran. So where do we begin? We can begin with just kind of the absurdity of every claim that Trump makes. There's an article yesterday that was like the 12 times Trump has declared victory. So yeah, we'll start with this. We'll start with the footage of striking Tel Aviv, as apparently last night was the biggest attack on Israel yet out of Iran. Which is interesting, because if we want to go to clip 38 here, this is what Trump said earlier today. Let's watch.
And when I read the fake New York Times, you take a look at it, it's like, oh, they're putting up a good fight. They're not putting up a fight. They're not even shooting at it.
Not even shooting at us, which is interesting, because clip 35 looks an awful lot like Iran shooting at somebody who looks an awful lot like us. And, this is one, just one of the many videos that went absolutely viral yesterday that seems to show that Israel, or that Iran can, in fact, continue to fire and are. And it appears as though Israel is taking the brunt of this as well. Again, we've just got that we're in this, like, laundry cycle revolution series where it's just Trump comes out, says something about Iran being willing to negotiate. And then about an hour later, you have Run come out and going, that's just not true. I don't know who told him that, but we're not negotiating. And then just rinse and repeat. You just do that over and over. In the meantime, between declaring victory and declaring, you know, Iran is, you know, totally destroyed, Iran is bombing the hell out of Israel and American bases and their Gulf neighbors. And Trump is routinely claiming that it's only going to get bigger and crazier and We're about to hit them really hard. You just wait. So again, kind of nothing to hang our hat on in any way whatsoever. In any way you're looking at it. Let's go to clip 27 here. So again, we just heard from Trump that they've totally defeated Iran. They don't even have BB guns anymore. They're knocked out. Now it's just a matter of mopping up the mess. But that's not true. Let's go to clip 27.
An Iranian strike deep in the heart of Tel Aviv. For the fifth straight day, the skies above the city lit up as Israel's air defense system intercepted one Iranian missile after another.
So apparently the missile interceptors are still working fairly well. But those are going to run out not too distant future, and Iran doesn't seem to be slowing down whatsoever. Israel under largest Iranian assault in weeks as missile salvo hits center. Israel is facing the largest continual Iranian assault since hostilities escalated 3 weeks ago, Channel 14 reported, marking a sharp escalation in the U.S.-Israel-Iran conflict. Iran launched its largest missile salvo, sirens sounding across central Israel as the missiles were detected, with explosions heard in Tel Aviv and surrounding areas, including Jerusalem and the Shepherd area. One missile reportedly carried a cluster warhead, dispersing bomblets over a wide area. Damage was reported in homes and vehicles in Rosh Hayin and Petah Tikva, while a bomblet also struck a playground in Petah Tikva. So again, they are still getting hit. And it looks like the ground invasion is still very much on the table. You've got the Telegraph speculating, is Trump planning a ground invasion of Iran on Good Friday? The president has suggested he could walk away from Iran and leave other nations to police the Strait of Hormuz, threatening that America, quote, won't be there to help you anymore. Traditional allies of the U.S. told one day that he does not need them, another day taunted as cowards, and then told they should hurry up and go to the Strait, are wondering how best to respond or whether Trump is playing a different game altogether. Ever since the start of the conflict, Trump has been sending out a blizzard of conflicting messages. The war is won. It's not a war, but an excursion. Iran has 10 more days to stop the fighting and make a deal. Companies should show some guts. Other countries should show some guts. Iran should open up the Straits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, when he said that the war could last 4 to 6 weeks, he meant it, at least for the initial phase of reducing Iran's ability to repel a raid, to retrieve its enriched uranium, and take strategic islands in the Gulf. Now, it does appear as though, the ground invasion is certainly on the table, certainly moving in that direction. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it may be happening right now, for all we know. This could be very well be what the announcement tonight from Trump is about, or he could wait till Good Friday and wait till the markets close. That also tends to be his strategy. But let's go to clip 28 here, just to set the table, just to lay it out. The great Michael Savage. Oh, it's Passover. It's a Jewish holiday, so get ready for war. They do tend to like doing that sort of stuff. So Michael Savage has come out strongly against the war in Iran. I want to go to that for a minute. Apparently it's his 84th birthday today, so happy birthday to Michael Savage. And he came out saying what everybody who's not an Israeli shill recognizes fully at this point. Let's go to clip 28. This is Michael Savage.
Bad one. We can be anything we want to be. So just try to be the good one and the wise one. And let us all pray for peace. Nobody wanted this war. Everybody wants this war to end as quickly as possible. Anyone with a conscience knows this war makes no sense. Nobody's buying the big lie. That's not to say Iran is a good nation. We know the mullahs are crazy and they live in the 7th century. But maybe war isn't the answer. I've heard the other side of it. We all saw The Godfather. Sorry, I have very bad allergies. We all saw The Godfather. When Fat Clemenza takes Michael down in the basement in that house in Brooklyn or Staten Island, wherever it was, and they're shooting the gun. And Fat Clemenza, as it was written, says, "We should have stopped Hitler at Munich." Remember that line? Puzo was a great writer. unless Coppola wrote it into the screenplay. I don't know. Great line. He says, see, Mike, we should have stopped Hitler at Munich. Then we would have avoided World War II. So there is a thought in this land that we should stop the mullahs now before they grow too strong and they can't be stopped. I can understand that, but I don't buy it. A year ago, we were told their nuclear capacity was completely destroyed. And now they've been bombed for a couple of weeks. What's left for them to fight with? Well, they have missiles. They could put a nuclear tip on one of them, I suppose. They could get it from China or Russia. Do you think by bombing them, they're going to stop? We're liable to drag China and Russia into the war. Do you ever think about that? What is to prevent Russia from...
That's great, Michael Savage, saying just what a lot of people are recognizing right now. However, something has changed here. Something has broken a little bit. And just a quick rundown from Uncommon Sense at Uncommon Sense 76 on X. Lindsey Graham now says that we should make a deal. Remember, he had a deep and informed conversation with Mickey and Minnie Mouse, and they convinced him that Iran is not the right military target. We could go on about that, but something happened. Again, we don't know what sort of magical intervention his fairy godmother implemented, but Lindsey Graham now says make a deal. Trump says to make a deal. Mark Levin is saying the war could end in a few weeks. Netanyahu is saying Iran is, quote, no longer a threat to Israel. At least he says they're not an existential threat. Europe is flipping on Zionism, in as is East Asia. Marco Rubio outlined changes strategic objectives to not include the opening of the strait or regime change. Trump discusses leaving Iran even without a deal. Bill Ackman says to buy stocks and that there will be peace. America is questioning their Jewish overlords, and Trump is less popular than ever, and no one wants boots on the ground. China and Russia are emboldened with sanctions removed. There's been a pivot, if I had to guess. The U.S. is staring down all of its options, and it doesn't like them. Either that or it's cover for a ground invasion with the 2,500 to 10,000 possible troops in the region. It's actually upwards of 50,000. Even so, what would that actually accomplish? If you want to physically take Iran, they would need 500,000 to 1 million troops. If you send 500,000 troops, you may get slaughtered. Public opinion would be even worse. While before I've only ever seen calls for escalation, everything now points to the U.S. trying to get out of a bad situation and trying to get out fast. And he's right. I mean, something has changed here. But that could just be the language being used has changed, and that everything is actually lining up to become the quagmire that we always expected. This is from Apollo Russo _ on X, and I thought this was a very interesting and informed breakdown. Isfahan Underground Tunnel Complex. So basically, the Spectator Index says the Pentagon is developing military options for a final blow in Iran that could include the use of ground forces and massive bombing campaign, according to an Axios report. So this was from March 26th. And then this is the analysis from Apollo. Isfahan Underground Tunnel Complex. The strike sequencing over the last month reads like a corridor preparation. First, the southern coastal defenses, the belt facing the Persian Gulf, was hit. Manab, Bandar Abbas, Kanarak. Then Iranian naval capabilities across the Gulf of Oman was gutted. Then missile infrastructure and mobile TELs were systematically reduced. Then internal security nodes across dozens of cities were hit, including Isfahan. This is the sequencing of an approach route being cleared layer by layer toward a terminal objective. And the obvious terminal objective is the Isfahan underground tunnel complex. 440 plus kilograms of uranium enriched to 60% stored inside, enough for roughly 11 nuclear weapons, weeks away from weapons grade 90%. The tunnels have no ventilation shaft openings, no structural weak points for penetrating munitions. Someone has to physically go in those tunnels. Every other option has been tried and failed. It's been exhausted. So that makes sense to me. If this is all about the nuclear enrichment, then that would be the target we'd be going for. And obviously, they are hardened against any form of weaponry we have from the air. We'd have to send men on the ground, and you could potentially do something like that, theoretically, feasibly, with a fairly small force, considering the fact that you're not actually trying to take over and occupy the whole nation. Just a Maduro-style in-and-out operation, and it seems like they're preparing the corridor in preparation for that. And there's basically endless, you know, reports and people noticing that everything is moving that direction. All of the naval forces, all of the Marine forces, all of the Air Force, the specific planes like the A-10 Warthog, which is specifically designed and utilized for infantry support. It all points to a ground invasion being imminent. And I think that is fairly accurate. It gets a little complicated, though. We can go to clip number 34 here. This is Senator Chris Coons, who I believe is a Democrat, if I'm not mistaken. But I should have liked so many other times in our history. Yeah, when the Republicans do something stupid, it turns out it gives a chance for the Democrats to win victories that they don't deserve. Let's go to clip 34 here. This is Chris Coons about what American Israel's intentions and all of this are.
That's a great question to which there isn't a great answer. President Trump, several days into the war, made it clear that he had thought that Larijani, one of the senior elected leaders of the Iranian government, was someone with whom he or his administration might have negotiated, but the Israelis assassinated him. The Israelis have attacked over and over the senior leadership of the intelligence services, of the IRGC, of the Ayatollah and his close advisors, and that has made it difficult for us to assess exactly who's in charge. But we do know this. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC, has a pretty firm grip on the country and has been trained in how to continue aggressive operations even when there isn't a clear central command. So I don't, in the near term, see an easy path towards there being a real change in the government or the regime in Iran.
And we've sort of given up on that anyway. I mean, we're still saying it, but we know what the answer is. We know what they want to create. They want to create a situation in which Iran is a broken state that we routinely bomb every couple of months. Nobody in America wants that, but that's the way Israel has operated with its neighbors forever. And it's really how they want to operate around the world, more or less, when you really get right down to it. But let's go to clip 17 here. But hold on, sorry. That video we just saw was Chris Coons, the senator who has access to the classified briefings, saying absolutely, and not in a speculative way, that we were hoping to work with Larijani or whatever his name is, but that, you know, less hardliner, he was going to be the one who we were going to prop up once we assassinated all the leaders. And then Israel assassinated him. And he says they routinely assassinate anybody that we want to work with. So once again, Israel got us into this war. The pressures of Israel set up the conditions for this war. And now our exit ramps for this war are being systematically eliminated by Israel on purpose to keep us in the war. They're the ones we should be at war with. I mean, they are at war with us just through Iran, essentially. That's how this is working. So that's important to note with Senator Chris Coons coming out and saying that verbatim. Let's go to clip 17 here. This is a former U.S. Naval Intelligence officer talking about the immense troop buildup that hints that, yes, the ground troops in Iran are very much still on the table. Let's watch.
Even though the war looks like it's happening in a massive aerial campaign, we've noticed just over the last 2 weeks, about 2 weeks ago, a series of flights started to move from the United States, which started to spell out that there was a much bigger picture going on. We started seeing flights that were at the main bases of the 1st and 2nd Ranger Regiments, large numbers of aircraft, enough to move the entire battalion. Special Operations Command, Tampa, Florida's Special Operations Headquarters, SEAL Team 6's headquarters, and then an associated U.S. Air Force unit that is only used to take contingency flights to repair damaged runways. This massive armada moved quietly to an air base in Israel, over to air base in Israel, and an air base in Jordan. The numbers that they are having there are far bigger than anything you would need for Karg Island. I was in the Navy. I served off Karg Island, had naval battles with the Iranians in the 1980s, hit mines. Let me tell you, Karg and the southern Strait of Hormuz Islands are a task in themselves. The Marines could handle that. But that combined with the 82nd Airborne, we are looking at something much, much bigger than taking those islands.
So again, we also are just moving our third aircraft carrier to the region. All of these signs pointing towards an actual invasion of Iran with ground forces. That's what the rumors are as well. As you just heard, that's what they're moving in that direction. You also have this from the Inside Paper. Military officials are planning for two potential ground assaults in Iran, one on Karg Island, the hub of the country's energy industry, and the other to seize enriched uranium to hobble Iran's nuclear development program. According to three people familiar with the matter, all they need is the go-ahead from President Trump. So again, that all falls in line with everything else that we've been looking at today. However, this could quickly become a world war. U.S. aims to be unpredictable with putting boots on the ground. Like, yeah, I guess. Fine. Chechen fighters are ready to deploy to Iran. Chechen units loyal to Kadyrov said they're ready to deploy to Iran if U.S. ground invasion begins. Forces describe the conflict as a religious war and potential intervention as jihad against U.S.-led aggression. Iran raises alarms over Ukrainian involvement, warning of widening geopolitical dimensions of the ongoing war, with Chechen military units announcing their readiness to deploy to Iran to support the country's armed forces in the case of a U.S. ground invasion. So this would be sort of a separatist militia that would be getting involved, or it could go with the blessing, the official blessing of the Russian government. Regardless, it looks like, you know, the dominoes are being set up for full-fledged World War III. Now, I want to go to clip number 13 here. This is the reality about what the war in Iran has become at this point, as we have successfully hit all of the military installations that we know about, and yet we're still getting hit with missiles. So what do you hit next? Go to clip 13.
You know, one thing that really struck me today when I heard the chairman briefing, General Kane, was that, you know, the increase in what they call dynamic targeting, meaning that they have the ability to retask aircraft after they've launched based on actionable intelligence. So what that informed me with is the fact that I think a lot of the principal targeting going after the weapon development industrial base, whether that's drones or ballistic missiles, and even the nuclear research and development centers, and certainly all the command and control, the major ones across the country, have been effectively either destroyed or degraded. So it sounds like, based on what we heard today, what I read and what was inferred is that absent of going after this national infrastructure that you just mentioned, the water, the electricity and the oil infrastructure, a lot of this significant targeting, minus what's buried very deep underground, has been eliminated.
So, yeah, that's basically us admitting that we've eliminated the military infrastructure we can reach, and so we're still getting hit. So now we're just resorting to exclusively bombing just basic critical infrastructure for Iran, which, of course, is a war crime many times over, strategically retarded. It's actually only going to backlash, since people that maybe didn't even like the Iranian government certainly are going to like you less when you blow up their children in a school. So we're not doing this. So like it's the same. You can ask the same question of like, well, why did Israel kill the person that we expected to take over? And if you're in the mindset of like, but don't they want this war to go our way? Aren't we trying to win this conflict for America? It's like, yeah, that decision doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. If you have somebody that you're ready to prop up as the puppet leader, why would you kill them? No, that doesn't make any sense. No, there must be some sort of alternative, ulterior motive at play here. And this is exactly the same. Why would you bomb critical infrastructure? If you know that they're only going to bomb your critical infrastructure, it's only going to get worse. You're only going to piss them off and, you know, more entrench the leadership. If they were actually trying to defeat Iran, they wouldn't even do this. They're doing it because the purpose is to create endless war. We'll get back into this on the other side. So a lot more to get into with Iran.
So, CIA declassified documents last week, Operation Artichoke, to poison vaccines, food supply, and the water to dumb us down and make us controllable. Now new documents about ESP control, how we're really electrochemical systems, liquid crystals, and the pineal gland, and how most people have microscopic to actual large worm infestations, not just from cats, you name it, like Kennedy has one in his brain, and they didn't tell the public most cancer, breast cancer, brain cancer is worms. Now, this is all over the place. Joe Rogan talks about it. I have for years. But here it is. Scientists and doctors figuring out now, the CIA knew in 62 that dewormers could reverse most cancers and didn't tell the public. That's mass murder. Here it is.
My parasite medications work against cancer cells. And it turns out that the parasites use mitochondrial substrate level phosphorylation in the tissue. And these embendazole, fenbendazole kill these parasites. So I tried it on the cancer cell,
And sure as hell, it targets the mitochondrial substrate and glycolysis. So we have a mechanism now why parasite medications are working. But cancer is not a parasite. All these people say, oh, cancer is a parasite. It's not a parasite. Parasites and tumors use a common metabolic pathway, and a drug that works against parasites can be very effective against cancer. And that's what we begin to see, especially under nutritional ketosis.
So to be clear, the anti-parasite drugs cut off the same mechanism in cancer, but we now know and have known that a lot of cancers from parasites, it's double good. And I don't sell that, but you can buy it online. And my medical doctor told me years ago, take this once a year as a regimen. I do. That's important information you might want to write down, folks, okay? All right. Ladies and gentlemen, you can look it up. Go to the UN's own website. They admit it. Over 2 million people have cognitive disabilities because they do not have enough iodine. In the 20s, they found this out. Sort of put in the salt. IQs went up about 20 points on average, 15, 20 points. Well, we have the very best atomic iodine in the world. Has been available in several years, ladies and gentlemen. But we have the original X2 back, but even stronger. Pure atomic. Atomic isn't radioactive. It means it's on the periodic table. It is absolutely pure. And I mix that with ultramethylene blue that is also on record good for your pineal gland and reversing the calcification, the rest of it. Your Doc Chambers on, medical doctor, special forces colonel, army colonel. And I said, what do you think of methylene blue? He goes, oh, I've been on it since 2004. When I got blown up in Iraq, I had brain damage because it blew away the sheath that's on my nerves. So I went and did research and found out that they had studies going back over 100 years on methylene blue helping regrow the sheaths on your nerves and all the rest of it. Well, we've got the best methylene blue, and I just mixed the iodine with the methylene blue. With this water, I'm going to drink this, and this is pure rocket fuel. So good for your body. Essential iodine with methylene blue together is amazing. Pretty scary looking, too. So, by the way, the new product is supposed to be available right now at theelvishowstore.com is T3. It's X2 back even better at theelvishowstore.com. So for all the fans that wanted it, everybody that wanted to get it, we have had it for over a year. It is back, reborn, like the Phoenix, even stronger. Exclusively available through our sponsor, theelvishowstore.com. But regardless, our methylene blue, our iodine is the best, and it does so many other things. Libido, stamina, energy. It skips the oxidation process in the cells. The methylene blue and iodine works very similarly, and they go together like a horse and carriage. Get them both now. There's also another big sale as well at thealexshowstore.com, and I thank you for your support.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Something happened on X where they started cross-posting Japanese posts with American posts and inspired me to go back to 2019, do a little highlight and video of my time in Japan. Probably the best 2 weeks of my life. It was freaking amazing. I love Japan. It was a great place. And I'd love to live there. I think it would be a great place to live. You know what I would never do? You know what I would never do to the Japanese people whom I respect and admire? I would never break into their country and live there against their will and then file a court case when they try to tell me to go home. Because I'm a decent person that actually appreciates Japan and would want to contribute to it, not be a parasite and a burden. I don't know why we don't get that level of respect from anybody else around the world, but it's not too much to ask. And yet, it's constantly withheld from us, that just basic respect, basic appreciation of the desires and the will of the American people. You would think, if anybody, you would think they'd be welcoming me with open arms. Guess what? They don't have to. And I respect that because I like them. And anybody that doesn't respect that doesn't like us and doesn't belong here. So I thought I'd play that a little bit. Thought I actually did a pretty good job while also not using a single image that showed my wife's face. It was difficult. Would have been a lot better if I could have shown her face. But again, this is the basics of the conflict here in America, is that for some reason we just allow ourselves to be disrespected, allow ourselves to be taken advantage of. We allow people who don't like us, don't want to contribute to us, literally just see us as a giant bunch of suckers to scam to the nth degree, and they want to come here to scam us and then send all their money back home. Why would we ever allow this? And this is the thing. Right now, the Supreme Court is debating birthright citizenship. Birthright citizenship is absurd. It's absurd on the face of it. It may have had a role to play back in the 1800s when it was first implemented. And this is why this whole thing is nonsensical, is because these arguments, I get how the law works. I understand why we do things this way. It seems like a vestigial, like, holdover of an earlier time where maybe this would have made sense. But right now, it's like, the question is simple to me. Should somebody be allowed to enter our country, plop out a baby, and they are therefore American? The answer should be absolutely not. What the hell are you talking about? That's ridiculous. Of course not. How would that even work? Are you crazy? There are just 7 billion people that can get here in a plane flight. They can all just stop over for an afternoon, have a baby at our expense, and then that baby can just collect Social Security, vote in our elections. I mean, this is absurd, right? But you can't just look at a problem as it exists right now and provide a solution for it. You can't even, we aren't even writing laws to actually match the world as it exists right now. We're going to the Supreme Court to decide on a case based on precedent from over 100 years ago. So the entire Supreme Court argument are like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like we're arguing about laws that were made to deal with laws that don't exist anymore. Okay, so here's the thing. In the 1800s, there was naturalization in America was exclusively available for white Europeans. That was the only people that could be naturalized as citizens. So the case they're talking about in the Supreme Court today, or at least they make reference to these cases, is like, okay, but you have a Chinese guy that comes over here and is, for all intents and purposes, a citizen. He's lived here his whole life. He's moved his whole family over here. He's made himself an American in every way he possibly can, except for, you know, blood and race. But our Constitution, as it existed then, didn't have provisions for a Chinese guy to become American. It just didn't exist. And so they wrote this law in the 14th Amendment to be, or, you know, at least part of it was about this idea of like, all right, well, you can't naturalize him because he's not white. So, but if he lives here and this is his domicile, then maybe we can make a provision for him. And so it's like the whole reason the 14th Amendment exists is to deal with people that are excluded by a naturalization law exclusive to Europeans that doesn't exist anymore. So we got rid of the naturalization law that meant the 14th Amendment was necessary, but we still have the 14th Amendment, even though that law doesn't exist anymore. This is the type of stuff that it's like, what are we doing? And like half of the conversation is them debating on the definition of words as understood by people in the 1800s. Again, I understand that it's like, okay, you set precedent and then you have to interpret the law. And as time changes, you have to go back and say, okay, does this word still mean the thing that it used to mean? If not, how do we update it? I understand. But it just seems ridiculous to me. It just seems, I mean, in fact, it is ridiculous. What should have happened a long time ago is that the 14th Amendment should have been eradicated and there should be a new law by Congress. Congress should write a new law that just says, hey, guys, to be an American citizen, one of your parents has to be an American citizen. That's the law, problem solved. That would be it. With no more discussion, no more conversation, no more debating, no more getting out a dictionary from 1806 to determine what exactly they meant by allegiance. Like, what if you just wrote a law in Congress that said, the 14th Amendment is no longer applicable. We're not going to do it anymore. We don't need it. It's not, it literally is not necessary. It doesn't comport itself with the modern world. So we have to get rid of it. We have to change it. Instead, we're trying to go back in time and ascertain what the people who wrote it thought, even though obviously the world and its conditions as it exists now, if they could have foreseen what was to come, they didn't want any of this stuff to happen. They wouldn't be okay with any of this. I mean, the you know, really amazing example that's come out over the last couple of weeks is this island in Guam where you have thousands of Chinese moms giving birth to quote-unquote American babies. You tell me, like, just tell me if you can figure out the answer to this question. If you were to go back to 1868, when Chinese people were still slave workers building railroads in the Midwest, and ask the people who wrote the 14th Amendment, is the thing that you're writing right now, does it mean that if a Chinese woman goes to an island on Guam and then back in China, that baby is American? Do you really, like, is there any question that those people would be like, well, it's a complicated issue. I understand that. It's like, they'd be like, what? No. What is Guam? What are you talking about? Absolutely not. Is that what people think that we're writing? We need to really be more explicit here. Like, and that's another part of it. I think also genuinely the people in the past, they wrote things with the assumption that, like, the character of the nation would continue. And this is one of the, I don't know, misfires of Thomas Jefferson. See, Thomas Jefferson thought that the morals and the construct, or what, that the people would stay the same. Sorry, it's a little confusing. I'm messing it up. Thomas Jefferson basically said that, like, every 20 years there would have to be a new government, because they understood that they were trying to make a government that would have to change and operate in time with emerging technology and emerging just the modern world. They knew that, like, they couldn't write something that could go unchanged, right? It would have to change, and it might have to change completely. Like, Thomas Jefferson straight up thought, like, yeah, maybe in 20 years we just destroy the Constitution and start over with something new. They thought that the mode of government and the function of government would change, but that the people would stay the same, more or less, and just have to change government to fit with the modern times. The opposite has happened. We have sort of calcified our government structure into a form that just does not make sense anymore, while the world and everybody in America has changed entirely and, like, doesn't even have a theory of mind for what the founders were like how they thought and what their opinions were on things. And so, you know, in the 1860s, when the 14th Amendment was being written, you know, they wrote it just not thinking that they would have to explain these things. Like, they could not have guessed that there would be these subversive infiltrators 200 years later that would be twisting their words beyond recognition. They wrote it in, what's the phrase? It's like, good effort. You know, we need a revolution every 20 years just to keep the government honest. Like, that's what Thomas Jefferson thought. And yet the government that he created is still operating 250 years later. It wasn't supposed to, guys. We were supposed to change this. We should change this. This doesn't make any sense, especially when you have people like Ketanji Brown Jackson making an absolute fool of herself. And I have a series of clips. I clipped them out myself, so it's not just stuff downloaded from the internet. And it's a series, and it's basically one chunk, but I cut it up into four pieces, because each time it's Ketanji Brown Jackson bringing something up. And this is the thing. From Ketanji Brown Jackson's point of view, she's going into the record. She's going into the debates that happened, because we have the records of the debates, exactly what was said. There's no we don't need to speculate about if these people thought that they were writing a law to allow 10 million Mexicans to have free citizenship as long as they break our laws first. Like, this is ridiculous. But she's going back, and she's not looking at it in good faith. That was the term I was looking for. She's not looking at it in good faith and going, I want to figure out what they really meant here. She's looking for little isolated, out of context phrases that she can dislocate from the rest of the conversation and use to build her, you know, straw man argument. It's like, is this what a Supreme Court justice is supposed to do? Instead of just, like, actually genuinely trying to understand what the people who were writing it actually meant so you can best enforce the law, she's literally just, like, she knows that it's not the law, that the way she interprets it is not the way they interpreted it. And so she's deliberately misconstruing statements from the debate. And so this is a series where she brings something up, the lawyer for the government arguing against birthright citizenship just smacks her down, like, so perfectly. It's insane. And it's very funny because she interrupts him every time. Every time she's like, well, what about this? And he's like, yeah, that actually is in our favor. That's actually arguing for us. And you see, and she's like, well, okay, well, that may be so, but what about this over here? And he's like, yeah, that also is evidence of our argument is right. She's like, well, okay, well, that may be. Let's not talk about that anymore. Let's move on to this next thing. Like, it's so embarrassing. I would think if these people had shame, they would be so embarrassed, but they don't. So we'll just have to talk about it and mock them regardless of how they feel. Let's go to clip 53 first. So this is Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asking about the debate in 1868 and being told by the lawyer for the government, yeah, you are completely misinterpreting that. This entirely goes towards our argument, not yours. And then she interrupts him and cuts him off. Let's watch.
But if the Supreme Court had, prior to the 14th Amendment, established that allegiance meant the common law definition, I think your first hurdle is to help us understand why we would believe that when the 14th Amendment was ratified, the framers weren't just incorporating what we had previously said it meant.
Page 572 of the Congressional Record directly addresses this. They say the concept of temporary and local allegiance from the Schooner Exchange is what is meant by, or temporary and local jurisdiction from the Schooner Exchange is what is meant by the word jurisdiction in the 14th Amendment. Senator Trumbull says, I thought about saying owing allegiance, but again, quote, there's a sort of allegiance from persons temporarily resident in the United States whom we have no right to make citizens. So he expressly and consciously.
Okay, well.
She's like, well, what about this? He's like, this person expressly and deliberately says you're wrong. She's like, okay, we'll move on to the next point here. And this happens four times in a row, just like this, okay? So let's go to the next one. I got to figure out which one the next one here is. The argument supports us. Yeah, so this is the one where, again, she tries to bring something up that she has cherry-picked and isolated and said, well, if you take this out of context and read it through a modern lens, then it kind of seems like the guys that wrote this might be on our side. And the guy's like, no. If you take it in context, they literally debate the point that Ketanji Brown Jackson is making and decide that she's wrong back in 1868. And she should know this because she read it, but she's deliberately ignoring or being deliberately ignorant of the reality of the conversation that was happening and claiming that, you know, trying to take something out of context to frame it as if the framers of the 14th Amendment actually consider this. Like, she's just lying, and she again gets totally smacked down. Clip 54.
I mean, that's a debate, and it's a discussion, very valid, but then we have a subsequent debate.
Sorry, I got to pause it there. Because again, all these clips are one after another, right? So the last clip that you just heard that just ended, when he's like, this expressly says that you're wrong. She's like, but that's a debate. Okay, we can have that debate. It's not a debate, lady. So sorry, I think it's funny that she's just perfectly diametrically wrong, proven wrong. And she's like, well, that's a debate. It's not a debate. Sorry. Back to the idiot.
I mean, that's a debate, and it's a discussion, very valid. But then we have a subsequent debate between Fessenden and Wade, where the same concept comes up, and it becomes clear, at least from Senator Wade's perspective, that that's wrong. So Fessenden, and I'm not sure whether these are senators, I apologize. Fessenden says, suppose a person is born here of parents from abroad temporarily in this country. Wade responds, the senator says a person may be born here and not be a citizen. I know that is so in one instance, in the case of the children of foreign ministers who reside near the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So it appears as though in that exchange, at least Senator Wade believed that the English common law understanding of what it means to have allegiance, to be a temporary person on the soil, was what was being adopted.
Yeah, that exchange strongly supports us. If you look at it in context, Senator Wade has introduced a version that says only birth on U.S. soil and doesn't have any allegiance or jurisdictional element to it. And so Senator Fessenden stands up and says, well, that can't be right because, you know, obviously, what about the children of temporary visitors? It has this, you know, it's another one of these statements that has this appeal to a background understanding that we all agree that the temporary visitors, their children do not become citizens. And then Senator Wade has to kind of backtrack and say, well, what are they, children of ambassadors? And in the end, Congress does not adopt Senator Wade's proposal. So we think that to the extent you can draw an inference from that, the inference strongly supports.
All right.
Okay, all right. So I was totally wrong about that, and it actually supports your argument. Okay, well, that's interesting. Yeah, duh. So again, she's making a point, taking one sentence or whatever out of a debate, you know, one exchange, and it's like, yeah, but that exchange ended with them making the conclusion that you're wrong. And basically, it's like originally they were debating, should it just be anybody born here? And they're like, no, that's ridiculous, because what if you have an invading army? Are all of their kids citizens? That's ridiculous. What if you have an ambassador that's just visiting here, their kid's not going to be a citizen, a temporary visitor, somebody just passing through, they're not going to get us. So it has to be more than just having been born here. They have to be permanent residents here. They have to domicile here, meaning it's their permanent home. They have no plans on leaving. And that's where Ketanji Brown Jackson gets really confused and starts debating whether or not babies can have allegiances. Again, this is like, go back to 1868. And when they're sitting there, you know, in their smoke-filled rooms and their tuxedos and their top hats and beards, and they're going, you know, well, clearly, if it's somebody with an allegiance to another country, if you were to go back and be like, is it the baby's allegiance? Like what? Do we need to write? No, babies don't have allegiances. Like, what are you talking about? How could this possibly have been what they intended? It's the millennial woes. Retweeted text that people post all the time. They just pretend to be stupid. They pretend not to understand. This is obvious. It's not the baby's allegiance that's at question. It's the parent's allegiance that's at question. So this was the next question, Ketanji Brown Jackson. That's two in a row. Two things she brings up that just get immediately smacked down with the primary sources by the government. All right, we'll move on to the next part. Do babies have allegiances? And it's like, okay, great. Supreme Court of the United States. Let's watch clip number 55.
Well, let me just ask you about why we wouldn't see in the 14th Amendment anything about parental allegiance. Several of my colleagues have talked about the fact that your view of this turns on what the status of the parents are, and not the child, as would the born in the United States view of it. Can you help us understand why we wouldn't expect to see a mention of parents in the text of this amendment?
I think it was well understood that, for example, children cannot, you know, newborns cannot form domicile. So it followed every 19th century.
That assumes domicile is in the test. And I'm asking you, how do we know that Congress did adopt the test that you say it adopted?
Yeah, when you're looking at 19th century conceptions of allegiance, the notion that the allegiance, again, you say domicile is instantiating the concept of allegiance for aliens as opposed to citizen. All of that, the 19th century understands the newborn's domicile, its allegiance follows the allegiance of the parents. And I point out that their theory relies on parental allegiance as well, because they recognize the exceptions for, you know, hostile invading armies, for tribal Indians, for ambassadors. Again, the child's allegiance status, even on their view, turns on the status of the parent.
Yeah, yeah, okay, all right. Babies don't have allegiances. I'm keeping up with you there. The hell are you talking about? What are you talking about? And like, this gets absurd. Amy Comey Barrett asks a question, what happens if we don't know who the kid's parents are? It's like, I don't know. How is that even possible? You know that they were born in the United States, but you don't know who their mother is? How could that even occur? Are you trying to write a law that can somehow also contain within it potentialities that literally cannot exist? Like, why would the law need to say that if we don't know who the parents are? Tell you what. If ever there is a baby born for which we don't even know who their parents are, but they're born in America and we see them being born somehow without knowing who their parents, tell you what, in that case, yeah, sure, that kid can be a citizen. I'm willing to make that little caveat there, just in case there's any sort of spontaneous manifestation of babies, they get to be American citizens. There's some sort of beyond miraculous conception, miraculous delivery with no mother. It's, yeah, okay, that the miracle baby gets to be American. I'm okay with that. Why are we talking about this? What the hell are we doing? How is this the United States of America in the year 2026? Let's go to the next one. Let's go to, again, she can't understand that she, it's deliberately misunderstanding, being deliberately ignorant, and it's so infuriating that this is the way that the future of our republic is being litigated. Let's watch.
We're supposed to do this. Don't worry about the people who are already here and who would not qualify under your rule. How does this work? Are you suggesting that when a baby is born, people have to have documents, present documents? Is this happening in the delivery room? How are we determining when or whether a newborn child is a citizen of the United States under your rule?
And I think that's directly addressed in the SSA guidance that's cited in our brief. What SSA says is there's currently a system where, for example, Social Security numbers are generated based on the birth certificate. They say this can still be, for the vast majority of instances, completely transparent. You will still get a...
Transparent. I'm just talking about the particulars, because now you say your rule turns on whether the person intended to stay in the United States. And I think Justice Barrett brought this up. So are we bringing pregnant women in for depositions? What are we doing to figure this out?
No, as I pointed out earlier, the executive order turns on lawfulness of status. So if you give birth to a baby in the hospital right now, it gets the birth certificate in the system. There's a computer system.
So there's no opportunity. There's apparently no opportunity then for the person to prove or to say that they actually intended to stay in the United States.
Absolutely not. The opposite is true. Their opportunity to dispute if they think they were wrongly denied, which would only happen in a tiny minority of cases, is directly addressed in that guidance.
After the fact.
Yes.
After their baby has been denied citizenship, then we can go through the process.
Yes. And the way that, I mean, I'm summarizing because I'm not an expert in computers, but there's a computer program that currently automatically generates a Social Security number. SSA says, look, a Social Security number, non-citizens can have them if they work authorization, so it doesn't prove citizenship. We'll give you a Social Security number, provided that there's the system automatically checks the immigration status of the parents, which there are robust databases for, and then it appears no different to the vast majority of birthing parents.
So again, I genuinely don't even understand what she was asking. What? She's like, oh, so we're going to be deposing pregnant women? What are you talking about? If they're a legal citizen here to stay because they're on a permanent visa, then they're domiciled here. Like, this is not complicated. They're literally creating non-existent circumstances to try to come up with a reason to oppose this. This whole thing is absurd. This shouldn't even be at the Supreme Court. If they actually decide, in favor of birthright citizenship, that's basically it for the country. I'll show you one more clip on the other side in the first 5-minute small segment that really shows you how broken and lost and in need of replacement our system is. And then Royce White joins me to talk about the Antichrist activity.
In a world where globalists, depopulationists, principalities, and powers of the air have been adding, spraying, and inundating humans with heavy metals, chemicals, and toxins, TheAlexJonesStore.com would like to introduce a new way to remove them from your body from the inside out. Introducing zeolite. Zeolites are a group of crystal-like porous minerals that are found where molten stone meets water. From the Greek zeo, to boil, and lithos, or light, meaning stone, this unique network of tiny little holes and channels found in zeolite absorb and remove harmful substances like heavy metals, chemicals, and other toxins. So don't delay. Start the process of removing unwanted toxins from your body and put some skin in the game of the info war today by going to TheAlexJonesStore.com and picking up a bottle of zeolite.
Whatever the future may hold, InfoWars will always live forever. The fight will continue. Be sure to follow us on X at RealAlexJones and at AJNLive. And now you can download the number one news app in the world. Go to AlexJonesApp.com and let the Democrat Deep State Party know that we will never be silenced.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.